Berlin Alexanderplatz is an amazing novel and resource, right? It is an up-close, very direct depiction of life on the streets of Berlin in the late 20s, right? But it's going to give you a feeling for the desperation and the economic dislocation and so many things of the whole Weimar era, okay? And so it's very valuable just as a historical document. But it's written in a modernist style, okay, that also gives you a feeling for what we talk about and are fascinated by as Weimar culture, where the expressionism and the cubism and the futurism and the abstraction that had been developed pre-1914, right, are used to better describe what's going on in the world after the First World War, okay? And the style has come to be known as stream of consciousness. It's derived from James Joyce and in France, Apollinaire. But this effort to give you, in an unfiltered way, the ideas and sounds and sights and smells that, as they filter into the character, okay? And that means it's difficult reading. It's jumping around. But it's not as difficult as Joyce. There's still a narrative line. So if you, some of you are familiar with, it's more like John Dos Passos, which is a stream of consciousness style, flitting back and forth between different characters, but also inserting bits and pieces from the newspaper, bits and pieces from popular song, and so on and so forth. So you just have to remember, it's bouncing back and forth as it tries to give you this full feeling for what's going on, right? And in that sense, you need to be prepared for that conceptually. So the first lecture that you'll now listen to is my effort to describe sort of the bridge of the gap between expressionism, where we left off, and these other modernist forms up until Döblin starts to pen this, okay? So it's really a survey of Weimar culture, including film, including some of the music, and so forth, okay? The next lecture talks at the beginning about some of the specifics of German politics, so a quick survey of some of the main issues of Weimar politics, before starting to talk about the book itself, okay? Now, and with that said, the book is by Alfred Döblin, right, who was an expressionist writer, right, but also a medical doctor trained in psychiatry, okay? So his day job is working as a doctor in the poor neighborhoods of Berlin. So he knows this world well. That's why you can get this incredible grit and incredibly up close and personal description of what one of these individuals would be. And what he's done is to imagine and project himself, like Joyce does for Leopold and Molly Bloom in Ulysses, into the mind of an average guy just trying to survive on the streets. His name is Franz Bieberkopf, and he is being released from having been in jail for four years, and I think he's coming out in 27, right? He's been in jail, I think, for sexual assault, okay? And he's just coming out of jail as the novel begins, right? But he has previously served, so he's a veteran as well, right? And what you're going to get is this kaleidoscopic picture of his experiences from his perspective. Okay, so it's remarkable in terms of its historical detail, but also in terms of its modernist style. So you have to get yourself ready for that. And to help you through it, besides my explanations as it goes through, on the site, I've provided a synopsis. So you can follow the story along, right, at the same time as you sort of look for the themes that I've listed here for you to pay attention to and that we'll emphasize as part of the Weimar experience, as well as Weimar culture.
The term Weimar, not Weimar, but Weimar, W-E-I-M-A-R, that comes from the town where Goethe lived, and a number of important cultural breakthroughs took place. For instance, Nietzsche's home was there. That's where he, retired. His sister's house was there, and so the Nietzsche archive has been there all along, even though the East Germans didn't make much of that. But they definitely kept Goethe's house in good shape. And so it has this pivotal significance in the cultural tradition of Germany. But the reason this era is named the Weimar era or the Weimar Republic is that during the street fighting that was taking place in 1919, as the republic was consolidated, the constitutional assembly had to move to Weimar. So the republic was actually founded in Weimar, and that's why it's referred to as the Weimar Republic or the Weimar era, just so you know. We'll talk a little bit about that street fighting. But first, I just want to give you, as I did last time, a visual introduction to this segment and a visual complement to what you're reading. And what I'm going to click on here in a moment is a film called The Symphony of a Big City, Symphonie einer Großstadt in German. So symphony, but with an IE instead of a Y. And then einer Großstadt. Which is simply a symphony of a big city. This is a really interesting document, film document. We use the term document for anything that we're exploring, whether it's on paper or not. It is a film, a contemporary film, of imagery from the life in Berlin. And Berlin was one of the biggest, hippest, most modern of cities in the world, the European equivalent, of New York City at the time. At least it had that reputation. And a lot of exciting things that we're going to talk about through the day today were taking place at that time. It was very hip, as it's become again right now. Right now, Berlin's probably the hippest city in certainly Central Europe, but maybe Europe as a whole. I mean, Parisians have their thing going, and London's very hot, but it's really expensive. So a lot of people are hanging out in Berlin, and there are a lot of new clubs and a lot of new bars and a lot of cutting-edge cultural things going on there. So it's kind of regained its position, but it was at least symbolically the center of whatever was new during this period. And we'll talk about how positive that was or how negative was or just how people perceived it through the day today. So these filmmakers attempted to capture that. And they captured it, as you'll see, through a collage style of filmmaking. Now this is 1927, 1928, 1929 when the book is being written. And the ideas of how to filmmaking are developing and being substantiated. And some of you may know about Serge Eisenstadt and the whole notion of collage style. That's not the term he uses. Montage style film editing. Eisenstadt did this sort of thing, for instance, with the Potemkin, Battleship to Potemkin, and Ivan the Terrible, and so on, where you piece together images, the guns of a battleship firing, the people screaming, and your mind puts the two together, synthesizes it, and said the guns are shooting on the people and they're running. So it's your mind that puts the shots together and develops the narrative. And this is very complex, and I'm simplifying it terribly, but if you go into film studies and so on, that's just going to be central to what you learn, just putting these images out there, and it's in the really in the mind of the viewer that the story is constructed, and that's how film is done to this day, sometimes more seamlessly than other times, and Hollywood films and more mainstream things make that storyline seem to run fairly smoothly, and more avant-garde films put together juxtapositions that are harsher and more contrasting, and they're a little bit more difficult to follow, and therefore require more interpretation and may seem a little bit more bizarre and strange and so on. But it's basically doing the same thing as putting those images together. So the filmmakers of this symphony of a big city, they're on the cutting edge of using this montage or collage style in a modernist way, which isn't as seamless, which shows its seams. In other words, just flashing images up there, image of the city, and you put it together. There's no story here. There's just this feeling for the big city that they're trying to communicate. And there's a musical concept there. It's actually a symphony of a big city. So you take these images and put them together as you might experience sound. Maybe not asking exactly what they mean, but just experiencing them for what they are. So it's a very modernist mode of communicating the experience of urban life. And that's very much part of this Weimar culture, a celebration of that urban life, of that speed, of the sort of disorientation, of the mechanization, of the industrialization of life, that you're all more or less hip to these days, but which was very new at that time. You know, the bouncing around, information coming in from all angles at all times, noise, entertainment, information, newspaper headlines, radio, the excitement and sounds of big city streets, cars coming at you, streetcars going by you, crowds, street fights, prostitutes walking by, and so on. Right? How do you capture all of that? I'm going to go backward in a little while and talk about how artists were working to do that, but film then steps in and becomes a very important way of communicating that very modern experience. So let me open with a few shots of this, because I think you'll get a sense of maybe a cinematic source for the kind of things that de Bleijn is doing with his imagery and with these blips and pieces of data coming from the urban life as they flit through the mind of Franz Bieberkopf or the mind of the reader in reading Berlin Alexanderplatz. This version of it was silent, and you'll see various efforts to put music to it. There was original music written for it, but I didn't have that. So I just put to the back of it the songs of Kurt Weill, who's writing at this time with Bertolt Brecht, sung by a really cool performer named Ute Lemper, Utelemper. And she does performances where she reconstructs the feel of Weimar cabaret, Marlene Dietrich's world, Kurt Weill's world, Bertolt Brecht's world. So I thought that was a good fit. So you just had that opening collage business, which just played around with shapes, but then boom, this rapid shots of what it's like to travel on the train, right? Now this has become part of everyone's life. The First World War, millions of people had the experience of train travel, right? It's been around, of course, but now it becomes part of normal life. But that speed, that sense of things clicking by, flashing by, here's film trying to catch that, the disorienting feel of it. At the beginning of the 19th century, they said it was very dangerous to look out the window of a train because you could suffer brain damage, right? But here are some filmmakers who want to give you that sort of dizzying experience of speed and travel at that time. As you move through the suburbs, into Berlin. Those are these little gardens that Germans still have out there on the outskirts of town. But then moving into the industrial sector, right, and then gradually into the suburbs and into the city itself. So you do have this very modern experience of coming into the city on a train. Of course, Pons doesn't come in on the train. He's just getting out of jail in Tegel, which is already in the city, so you don't have that. But I could imagine Dublin putting together one of his collages to capture that here. You should see the new train station in Berlin now. It's just unbelievable. Trains are still the way to get around in Europe. It's fast, it's smooth, it's incredible. So you can have a similar experience when you travel there. Now, here's downtown Berlin. And for us, I just want to point out, this is all gone, okay? Most of it. This was flattened in the Second World War. So if you go to Berlin in search of some sort of historical romantic experience of 1920s Weimar era Berlin, it's very hard to do. And strangely enough, this film is often showed in movie houses in Berlin to draw tourists who want to see what it was like. And they've come to Berlin and it's kind of hard to find it. Although they've done a reasonable job of reconstructing things, in most cases you're in reconstruction. And I would just have to show you some images after the Russians had come in. I mean, this was all in rubble. Alexanderplatz, was just flattened, the center of the story, which you'll see some images of in a minute. So, here's just some shots of Berlin was never old. Berlin's not an ancient city. It really was built up in the 1870s. So it's a lot of steel, a lot of brick, and a lot of modern buildings. This is the Mosse Verlag, George Mosse's family's printing house, and designed by an architect named Mendelssohn. And it's very modern, a lot of steel and glass structures going up. Never as high as in Chicago because there were height restrictions there. But still, you do have a very modern environment. These are buildings of the turn of the century up to the 20s. So it's not an old Altstadt, Gothic, romantic world, even before the bombing. It's a very modern city, and I think it feels a lot like Chicago in certain spots. Okay, now I'm going to skip ahead here, just sort of hopping through more urban shots all the way through. And if you were to watch this whole thing, I could make a copy for you, or if you wanted to get it from, I think it's probably on Netflix. Netflix, I'm discovering, has just a tremendous European film collection now. It didn't have that at the very beginning, but they have every major German film and French film that I know of. Probably this one as well. So, just all this steel and brawn of this urban industrial environment. Crowds, masses moving to and from work. Right? Not as many cars, but you're going to see there are cars and trains as well. But still, this whole sense of being part of a crowd. Franz is moving around in this environment with these people. These are the, when he gets scared and sort of hides out, it's being this sense of alienation and isolation from crowds like that. 1958. Let me skip up ahead. Just a lot more of that sort of thing, and I'm just going to pick out some highlights. I mean, all of them are interesting. Industry in the city. We've lost our manufacturing, but that whole area where the restaurants and clubs are down on the south side and on the West Loop, right? That was scenes of industrial power in Chicago, and we're just going through the shells of them and going to these clubs there now, right? But that's the same environment that existed in Berlin as well. Thank you. And here's, this is the computer world, right? But it's typing, right? And then newspaper production, mechanization of telephones, right? So he's capturing all the same excitement that we would have, or they are, about electronic communication and mass communication. Here are the iPods and the Apple phones and so on and so forth. Well, these are the doggies. But anyway, this whole business, right? So that was exciting and new, and people seemed just as, would have been just as into that stuff as we are today. And that's what, to a certain degree, Dublin is capturing with all of this information coming at you. You're hearing it in the radios, you're hearing it, people maybe talking on the phone, he's overhearing conversations randomly, some of those are probably on the phone and so on. Sort of like now, you know, it's much more open than it ever was because we're hearing people have, you know, intimate conversations on the train into their cell phones, and I've even done it myself, you know. It's wild, but suddenly you have these windows into people's experiences as those voices show up. Now here are salesmen around the stores, street salesmen around the stores in Alexanderplatz. So this is definitely Franz's world, directly. This is where he's selling the newspaper, selling the shoelaces and so on. Here's the haggling that's going on. Some of these people are just selling on the street, randomly, on their own, individuals, or some of them are working for stores. In Germany, if you go out in front of a big dime store, they'll have people actually out there selling pots and pans and, you know, miracle workers for the household and so on, right there on the street. There's a little, this is a very famous movie, that a film that a lot of people have written about, all of these images and what they tell us. And what I just skipped back to was a shot that people interpret as prostitution taking place. So, I mean, we don't have to look too hard to find this in Berlin. It's pretty wide open, but I, since so much has been written on it, where is that? There. Hard to say. She seems a little too well-dressed for me to be a prostitute. But anyway, interaction between the sexes. Doesn't really have to be prostitution. Open interaction between the sexes. This is new. This is, you know, much talked about. Women walking alone, meeting men, and so on. That just wasn't done before the First World War. After the First World War, there are so many women who are alone, plus there's been a certain opening up of things, so you see that kind of thing, and it would have been notable. Here's a street argument, probably about politics, but who knows? Then the cops come in and clean it up. So we have a couple street arguments and fights taking place in the novel. That's what it would look like, more or less. There's the traffic. Mind you, all of these streets were flattened, gone, blown away. This was the most complex web of streetcars and cars in Europe at the time, all of that, and we flattened it. Now here's another point where film studies people have said she is going to get picked up and may actually be a streetwalker. But what's most important are these individual women moving around. That's new. And they've got their little Bubikopf caps on, hats on, and short haircuts, boyish haircuts. That was thought of as being very racy at the time. Short skirts. These are the equivalent of flappers. It's the flapper style. They call it in German the Bubikopf style, which means boyish haircut. And it was the opposite of the Beatles. The Beatles were growing their hair long, and they freaked people out. Women were cutting their hair short, and that freaked people out. It was perceived as transsexual, gender crossing at some level. And they work in these shots of the storefronts, all the marketing and selling going on, material world. Okay, now I'm going to skip ahead a little bit further. Again, I'd be happy to lend this to you if anybody wants to see more. But here are the newspaper headlines flashing at you, right? newspapers for every political party. You hear some of them. You hear of the Focus Beobachter. You hear of the Hotefana. Those are the Nazi papers and the communist papers. Every political group had its paper. Right? So you just had all these voices coming at you the way Fonz did. Here, I think we're going to get some more of these newspaper shots. So this collage impact of headlines screaming at you, the experience of having those headlines coming at you, scaring the hell out of you with whatever news will sell, right? And that impacts you, a sense of disorientation, fear, excitement, whatever it is. Here we go. Here's a whole sequence of the newspaper production. The newsboys, so that's what Franz would be doing, right? Some of them for right-wing papers, some of them for left-wing papers, and, you know, whatever the job would be. There you go. Boom. Crisis. Whatever. I couldn't see that one. Stocks. Money. 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 And then the sort of disorientation, the mechanization of life, but here's the disorienting aspect of it, riding on roller coasters at amusement parks. Woo! There's that spinning quality, right? Contrast between poverty and wealth. Even the natural world is spinning. Spinning, spinning, everything's spinning you around. There's Franz getting, feeling dizzy. Right? Just, the rooftops are caving in. Here's a suicide. You're all confused, you're dizzy, she's confused, she's dizzy, she's spinning. Right? Splash, people look. Looks like it was constructed, but right, that kind of thing. They've captured that whole part of the story. And of course, we get suicides going on in the background, murders going on in the background, in the newspaper, and so on. And now I'll just close out with sequences of nightlife in Berlin. You know, more of the same, but the entertainment world that's, you know, so important. The rise of popular culture, the rise of film, jazz, club, scene, well, you see. Now, mind you, novelists, poets, painters, musicians, ever since the turn of the century, they've been trying to figure out how to capture this and communicate to people what it was like to be there. But now with film, you can do a much more direct job of it. They love the mannequins. And you know, you can read into that whatever you want. ladies of the night, right, performers. This is the world that Marlene Dietrich came out of. And, you know, a subtext here that a lot of people have written about is just the mechanization of things and of entertainment. People are literally becoming sort of cogs in the machine. And you'll see some of the dance sequence and skating sequences where they suggest that here. These are the cabarets. This is the world of Isherwood's stories and the movie then, drawn from them. And arguably at this time, I mean, these were the liveliest, most innovative, wildest stages in the Western world, in Berlin at that time. Josephine Baker, that sort of was a reference to her, but she's come over and brought American, African culture and promoted it. Jazz is very hip. There's the Charleston. There's this mechanization. They're literally becoming sort of like machines with their automatic movements. By the way, this music is to shows that Weill is producing in Germany with Brecht, and then he goes to New York and becomes a very popular writer, and so he's producing this music. Here's from the Three Penny Opera, which is about the gangster scene in Berlin, so a musical about gangsters, trying to capture the same atmosphere that Berlin Alexanderplatz is capturing, but through song and drama. Mack die Messe, Mack the Knife, that's Mack the Knife. Murder, corruption, the underworld. Had to get the hockey in. Huge institutions for mass entertainment. These were very new at that time. This is probably in the summer, artificial snow and so on for people to go and experience. Indoor ice. It's a modern world. It's a world that you would know very well. This is not ancient history here. This is less than 100 years ago. And basic elements of the popular cultural world that you know were formed by then. But huge halls, auditoria for boxing matches. These six-day bicycle races, they're very famous. Or these bikers would come in and, you know, it was the equivalent of indoor Tour de France, where they would just ride and ride and ride and ride and ride for 6 days. Right? And people would watch these races and bet on them. Jazz. I don't think that Devlin does a lot with music besides songs that they're singing. But he certainly could have laid over jazz in the clubs. And all of this contributed to a sense of excitement for people who were open to it. A sense of liberation for women, for men who wanted to loosen up, for homosexuals who had never had a chance to act out, right? For cultural innovation. It was very exciting. Very exciting. But of course, for conservatives and people who aren't that comfortable with all of this mechanization, for the sense of speed, for the loosening up of morals, for the individuality, for the drinking and the partying and so on and so forth, this was a den of iniquity. This was a sign of the human decline. This was Sodom and Gomorrah. So it does trigger a backlash as well. Order, order, we need order, right? That's what Franz is constantly saying. Well, There are those who are going to look at scenes like this and say this was something that needed to be controlled and the clock needed to be turned back. And of course, we'll be getting to those guys pretty soon. So we'll leave them to their party. But this just gives you a sense of, first of all, the world, some visual examples of the world that we're reading about. But also, and maybe more importantly, of the modernist style that artists, whether they be authors like Dublin or filmmakers like, I should know the filmmaker of this film, I don't, were using to capture modernity. How do you capture the modern experience? How do you capture what it's like to be in the city? It's very hard to do that with traditional means. That just doesn't suggest the excitement, the speed, the variety of things, but also that disorientation, that sense of dizziness, the sense of sort of fear, the sense of foreboding that is also part of bouncing around in the city, that we're all part of, you know, jumping in a cab and going out partying and ending up at, you know, 2 a.m. somewhere down there in the South Loop. I mean, what am I doing here? Why, you know, why am I wandering around these old warehouses? I don't know, right? Someone said that this club was over here. We can't find it. We're slipping around on ice. You know, we've had quite a bit to drink. The towers are spinning around us. Right. This is that sort of dangerous titillation that they're trying to capture through these modern means, and you can't do that in a traditional way. So let's talk a little bit now about how the arts got to this point. And some background to this modernist voice since the point where we left off with expressionist style as we entered into Wilhelmine culture and Heinrich Mann. Now, as I told you then, Mann and his brother were writing, this is before the war now, we're going back to the turn of the century, at a time when artists were shaking any restraint they had about remaining true to visual reality. Okay. The Impressionists had actually started to loosen things up because they broke from the traditional way that had been in place from the Renaissance until the end of the 19th century by using their dabs to capture what we might call the pixels of sight and just let the paint stand for those splotches of color that we put together then in our minds. But they were really doing so in order to more accurately record that which they saw. They weren't really commenting on what they saw. So they loosened up the old rules, but they were still attempting to provide a very direct and immediate and accurate representation of what they experienced. But the next phase, the post-impressionist, and then the expressionists pushed things further. And the point was not just to communicate what you saw, but how you felt about what you saw, or what that sight made you feel, the subjective element. And really starting with Vincent van Gogh and Gauguin in France, but since we're concentrating on Germany, the Expressionist movement at the beginning of the 20th century starts to exaggerate colors, intensify them, and even break away from naturalistic color altogether, so that you get a painting of a girl with a green face. And that painting has very rough application of the paint. The artist didn't even attempt to really fill in all the blanks. And you have this very childish, harsh, heavy border around things. Not doing any of the things that since, let's say, Leonardo da Vinci, Western artists had done in order to give you a photographically accurate representation of a face or another object. But just roughing out what was present and then interjecting these very powerful colors that work symbolically. That force you to say, ooh, wait a minute, what does he mean by painting her face green, right? And that forces you to look and not just say, oh, that's a girl with ribbons in her hair. That's a girl with a green face. Why does she have a green face? And then you look more closely and you ask yourself, what does that green mean to me? And what is the artist trying to communicate by using that green? And then you sort of contextualize it. Well, they're interested in sexuality, adolescent sexuality, childhood sexuality, Freud's in the air, so on and so forth. Then you look at her and she starts to look a little bit sinister, and you notice, hey, it's not just her face is greener, but her eyes are blue, and her eyes sort of look kind of sinister. So beneath those ribbons and all the pink frill of a young girl, she's starting to look kind of sinister, right? And so is that some sort of indication of her coming of age, adolescent sexuality, the power of the woman femme fatale, she's starting to recognize that. And you're into a whole world that we sort of sum up today with reference to Lolita, right? Much more is communicated by breaking away from those traditional ways of rendering the external world into this symbolic world of colors, or just putting together combinations of images, whether accurate or not, that tell you something about the situation. Here is a self-portrait of a painter who's telling you a lot about himself. You know, you've got the model, but it's a very harsh, glaring model. It's not a beautiful, stylized, classical version of it. She's just a woman that happens to not have clothes on. He has this self-image as artist, but also soldier, and of course, most flagrantly, you know, the hand's literally cut off. So he's, you know, he's blocked. Who knows what? He's blocked psychologically. He's incapable of creating, right? Obviously communicating some sort of pessimism or anguish or nihilism even. So the expressionist, and we talked about Klimt and that sort of thing, breaking through in order to, you know, communicate that anxiety. That's where we left off, right? So moving ahead, before the war, right, someone like Kandinsky was originally working in the expressionist mode, using powerful, non-natural colors, primary colors, to give you a heightened emotional experience of some actual physical events that took place, places, objects, and so on. But he becomes bored with that. He feels like he's reached a dead end and that Western art has done so. And, of course, he's most famous for whatever reason, breaking through and pushing beyond the representative into the non-representative, the non-figurative. It happens fairly gradually, at least you can line up paintings that seem to suggest that, but he's obviously getting more interested in the arrangement of these colors for their own sake and less interested in the actual objects, although they're still there for a while. Houses, trees, hills continue to be present for a while, as things get more and more abstract, as he gets more and more interested in just the colors and shapes for their own sake. But gradually, well, here's sort of a real transitional painting where you still have the troika, some sort of Russian cultural references, a hilltop town, church towers, and this small trio of Russian singers there and a hill, right? But you have to look a little bit more carefully just to find those things and identify them, as he steps into the world of pure abstract painting. And what's going on here is an intensification of this effort to convey emotional experiences. And the course could have spent a lot more time on this at the beginning, but anyway, Kandinsky writes very articulately about what he was trying to do with pure color. And he literally sets up color, his palette, as a musician sets up a keyboard or approaches a keyboard. Just taking each of those tones of color, just like tones of music, right, for their own sake. Nothing more and nothing less than the power that they have to communicate sort of vibrations in the soul. And he says that high notes of color, like yellow, high vibration, communicate a sort of shrill high tone, like the highest notes on a piano, or the highest notes of a violin, or the highest notes of a trumpet, right? And that blues and darks are way down at the other end. Blues and blacks, those are the dark, deep tones down there on the other scale. and everything in between. And then when you select colors, right, you're sending out these packets of emotional information, just the way a composer sends out packets of emotional information by selecting the notes on a keyboard or in an orchestra. So to experience a Kandinsky is to go through, and you'd have to read through all of his, unless you have this innate, you've retained somehow against all the materialization of Western society and culture, which just says, oh, that's yellow, that's green, that's blue, if it notices them at all. Maybe you are in tune with the emotional vibrations of color, right? But he wants to revive that in the rest of you, so he provides some guidelines. And as you go through this, you don't just look at it as a whole and say, oh, my you know, 4-year-old sister could do that. You go in and enter into this very rich world of emotional exploration. And depending on where you start, you might hear the shrill tones and then counter that with the low tones and then move into a very dark and then jump over into something bright, which is also death, but it has hope. This is the kind of thing that he writes about. And then maybe into the red and the blood red of that, and then that mellows out into the orange, and then you go into the cool sort of mellow greens and so on. And you can literally, all you would need is one Kandinsky for the rest of your life, because you can float around and feel all these emotions constantly, and the variations are endless. And he calls them improvisations or compositions because he wants you to experience them the way you experience improvised music, right? Which you're probably most familiar with as jazz, perhaps. So that whole notion. But what you have here is essentially this reduction of the medium to its basic components. So what you're getting are packages of emotional symbols, symbolism, right? In each of these shapes, in each of these shapes, arrangements of color, right? So information's coming to you in these packets. You go through, and as you experience them, you put together the story, right? You put together the emotional response. And that's similar to what the filmmakers are doing. It's a collage method, right? Where you take those packets of images, you take those sequences. They're given to you in a disjointed, disorganized way, because that's the way information comes to you, both from outside and from within. But things don't come to you neatly, not in the modern world, not ever. But the moderns become more conscious of that, right? And so it comes at you in this random way, and then you put together a narrative. This is really the origins of that kind of thing. And Van Gogh really starts it, but anyway, Kandinsky intensifies it. So what you're getting are those packets or quanta, right? They're quanta of information coming at you. Now, all this is taking place before the First World War. Before the First World War. This takes place between 1910 and 1913. Kandinsky makes this transition. At the same time that over in Paris, Picasso is making the transition from post-impressionism into cubism. They're really born at about the same time. Okay? But since that's taking place over in Paris, I'll stick to things taking place further to the east. I am going to just show you a couple of examples of Italian futurism, though, because that sort of takes cubism, what's being learned in cubism just before the war, and applies it in a way that allows them to convey what it was like to be in this urban, industrial, mechanized world. Picasso and Braque did these very careful studies of the human form moving very gently, very gradually. Okay, that's what they started out with. The futurists picked up on that and intensified it so that they communicated what it was like to move through the city, to drive in a car, to ride in a train. And ultimately, they imagined what it would like to be in a mechanized war, which they thought would be quite beautiful on these terms. Okay, so they start out a little bit further into it than Braque and Picasso had started, and saw that by looking at what was early cinema, right, they learned that if you provided packets of information about, let's say, location of an object, the foot of the dog or the chain here, right, and did it simultaneously, you could give this sense of motion, even in a three-dimensional painting such as this, or a two-dimensional painting such as this. Right? But that's just a warm-up so that they could capture what it was like, for instance, to see an athlete striding through space or a soccer player running at you. But their real goal was to capture what it was like to, say, move through a city, riding in the cab down LaSalle at 2 in the morning as the lights flash by, riding in a motorcycle. Of course, things weren't going as fast as they are now, but it's all relative. It sure seemed fast to them. And to see electrical lighting and so on. So here's a painter trying to do the same thing that 20 years later the filmmakers are doing in the Symphony of a Big City, to give you a sense of all those lights flashing at night, the arcades, the movie houses and so on, as you move through the city, right, on a streetcar or in a car or in a bus. Or what it's like to say goodbye to someone at a train station. Train Central, all of this, is a symbol of all this motion and speed and so on. And here's the train somewhere in the middle, but what they're more interested in is the psychological impact that that train has on you. So they've broken down the traditional mode of rendering a scene using cubist and abstract techniques in order to give you the waves of energy, sound, the smoke, right, the sense of speed as one of those steam engines starts to mount and starts to pull out, and maybe even the emotional component as you say goodbye to someone, because the title of this is Farewell. You know, you're saying goodbye to someone there. So by breaking things apart, but then putting them together in this, you know, energized way, it's communicating vectors of force in the physical world, as well as vectors of emotional force in the subjective psychological world, how these experiences impact you. So all of this has taken place before the war. Futurism and abstraction had already been achieved before 1914. So much so that people like the Italian futurists imagined that the First World War would be very beautiful and exciting and sort of cleansing, right? when massive armies of sleek airplanes, sleek ships and trains and so on clashed. Right? Well, they weren't right about that, but they certainly had they did have a sense of how potent that whole thing would be. Now, one more thing to add to the mix. In the war itself, we've talked about how some people supported the war on the sort of notion of this myth of the front experience, and others fought it, at least retrospectively, as having been horrible and dehumanizing and all the things that we drew from Remarque. In the war itself, during the war, there were these voices of, frankly, draft dodgers for the most part, coming out of Zurich, which was the only place in Europe that was unaffected. I mean, it was affected because all these people were there, but Switzerland remained neutral. And so you had a lot of draft dodgers and anti-war, as well as left-wing opposition in Zurich. So you have these very famous situations where people like Lenin and Trotsky were in Zurich. But so too were artists who were fighting the war in their own way. And the Dada movement emerged from that. And Dada is very essential to the background of this whole Weimar culture as well. You have this effort to undermine any sense of logic. And as I think I said before, the principle is that logic was being used to justify the war. Reason and rational means were being used to prosecute the war. All of this science went into the technology of the war. All this organization went into the arrangement, setting up those offensives, deciding exactly how many shells were going to be fired, where they were going to be fired, when it was going to stop, when people were going to go over the top. All highly mechanized, highly logical. And the Dadaists said, if that's where logic is leading us, we don't want anything to do with it. So they come up with these ways to defy logic. How can you construct things that are completely illogical? And when you think about it, it's very difficult because we're so locked into logic and a reason for something and a meaning of something. So their goal is to come up with ways to produce things that are impossible to get your brain around. One of those is collage, the collage method. And here's an example of that is this Hausmannerspitters, I can never remember. This is Hausmann. So here's a German, they're both German actually, Hausmannerspitters, reaching into his bag of clippings, right? And you're probably pushing them around a little bit. It's a little too neat to be purely accidental, right? But maybe responding to an immediate accident, seeing what came out, seeing where things fell, and then maybe making some adjustments to fill that in, right? So a collage is an articulation of this rejection of the Western tradition of reason and logic. And it's a dark, humorous way of saying that war was baloney. Now, there are a number of others, but I'll skip ahead to the fact that quite a few of the leading Donatists in Zurich were German, and they went back to Berlin. And people like Raoul Hausmann and Kurt Schwitters and George Grosch go back and continue this quest to say what the background to what we were fighting for, the institutions that led us into war, and the principles that we fought for are now illegitimate. They have bankrupted themselves. But they're still around. The church, the state, the police, all of that stuff is still here. Right? We reject it outright. We have nothing but disgust and disdain for it. And they attack it with everything that they have. And what they do is to set up basically this alternative universe of Dada conceptualization. And they set up their own institution and make fun of the other one. We have the Oberdada, the head Dada, President Dada, Secretary of State Dada, Minister of Defense Dada, and so on, just satirizing the regular world. But the whole goal was to create things that completely undermine any sense of order, any sense of balance, any sense of logic, any sense of reason, any sense of planning, any sense of coherence, and so on. And they put together some very famous exhibits where people like George Grosch and Otto Dix are featured with direct attacks on authority and institutions of Wilhelmine as well as Weimar era society. Okay, now, people like Grosch and Dix are the stars of what we refer to as Weimar culture, parallel to what's going on in the cinemas we looked at and as what we'll be looking at the book in a few minutes here. Now, we've talked about Dix and his response to the First World War, his effort to capture how horrible it was. Now, he couldn't do this in the war because he was busy fighting it, so it takes a few years for him to produce this series called War that I highlighted last time in conjunction with Remarque's book. It takes a little while for a veteran to be able to communicate those horrible things going out there, like rotting corpses of men as well as horses, what really happens when a shell blows up in a trench. Right? To do so, Dix incorporates a lot of the techniques that existed before the war, but he applies them in order to convey how awful it was to be in battle. Here's futurism, those vectors of force, those strong lines, right, and a sort of chaotic, abstract representation of the human body in various forms of, you know, destruction, really, in order to convey to you what it's like to have a shell go off. They were excited about showing what it was like to watch a professional athlete or watch a car go by. Well, here's Dick saying, okay, I can use those techniques to communicate what it was like to be in a shell, a shelling. Right? Or, you know, what's it like afterward? Gruesome. But, you know, the only way to communicate is something abstract, dark, grotesque, which has a very expressionistic, disorienting feel to it. Right? So these techniques that were developed before the war are applied in order to communicate what things were like in the war and what it was like to exist with reference to the war afterward. Okay, so this is when German expressionism, you know, really comes into its popular form and the form that people most remember it by, with this very dark, sinister expression of dismay, disdain, anger, pessimism after the war. And along with Dix, George Grosch is doing a lot of the same things. He's reducing things down to very simplistic elements. Some of his most famous works are these very elementary cartoons. We would probably call them political cartoons, in which he captured the experience of the downtrodden, of the veteran who's been, you know, left to rot and doesn't have a job, and articulating that he's really Christ-like. Here's Franz Bibikoff, right? Here's an image of Franz Bibikoff, just beaten down by the circumstances, perhaps injured in the war. This guy's lost his leg as well as his hand, right? And then unemployment, and then, you know, destruction of the working class movement or co-optation of that. And Grosch goes so far as to really represent him as being Christ-like in his suffering. And then on the other side, you have his pastiches or caricatures of the enemy, those who are getting rich on all of this, the military industrial complex that profited from the war, wartime profiteers, but then others who profited from the inflationary circumstances, development of modern industry, and as a leftist, he's very critical of them and attacks them viciously, right, with this very raw expressionistic style. The presence of all these veterans, all these wounded veterans who'd just been blasted in the war. Remember, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. I can't remember the numbers, but like 21 million wounded. Every city street is just covered with these guys out there begging. What can they do? Not only are they blasted, but the economy's shot. There's nowhere for them to go. So they're out there with their cups, flowers, whatever it was, hands, legs, faces gone. It's just a constant presence in people's lives, in Paris, in Berlin, as well as in London, right? If they weren't hidden away in hospitals. But in Europe, in Germany, the economy was such that many of these people were out in the street. There weren't any hospitals to hide them in, right? Because the economy was in bad shape. So the fact that Franz is running into a number of these guys on the street and having conversations with them, and they're saying, you know, I got wounded in the war for what? You know, I don't know. Right? That's very much part of the experience. And Grosch, Dix, and Döblin are capturing that very powerfully. Here's a painting that you might initially say is an exaggeration, right? Three veterans sitting around playing scat. But it really isn't an exaggeration. By making it cartoonesque, he sort of forces you to look at it. If he did it with photographic accuracy, then you might say, well, I don't believe that's there, right? But by doing it in a cartoonesque way, he sort of, he can trick you into addressing this. But this wouldn't have been, this isn't a joke, right? There are guys walking around with half of their brain hanging out, and guys with false, fake jaws made out of wood because prosthetics weren't what they are now, right? And no legs, and, you know, some sort of breathing mechanism or listening mechanism because they've been blown away. This is not that far from reality. But through the expressionistic, futuristic, Dadaistic techniques, they slam you with it. They put it in your face. And it's really the only way that an artist can make you not only see these things, but feel them. And feel them. And maybe the most intense example of this, I think, and probably equivalent to what Döblin is trying to capture in this novel, is George Grosch's painting, which has a strange title because it doesn't have its title. It's just dedicated to a guy named Oskar Panizza. So that's all we know it as, dedicated to Oskar Panizza. But if you look in this, you have all these elements. Stylistically, you have expressionistic, powerful colors. futuristic representation of the city. I mean, if you went back, if I flash back to that image of the city at night, you know, the buildings up there sort of seeming to encroach on you, sort of falling in, the vectors of light. But then all these caricatures of the monsters who were in charge and most vociferous in society, the church, the political leaders, the industrial leaders, then their victims. There's literally a coffin with a skeleton riding on it. But then all these poor people, vociferous patriots with their flags waving and so on and so forth. Just this mix of all the horrors as well as the excitement, this sort of disorientation, but tinged with this blood red expressionistic representation of a sense of fear. You know, it may be exciting, it may seem liberating, but there's this sense of foreboding that runs through all of it. Right? After us, the flood. Right? There's a storm coming, we don't know what. Right? In English literature, Yeats's Second Coming, right? The falcon without a falconer, things fall apart, the center cannot hold, right? We don't know what rough beast is coming towards us. Right? All of that is very intensely communicated in this post-war atmosphere of Berlin. Most of this is being produced in Berlin. Now, just one more bit of touch points for you. Touch points that you can use, I think, to get a feel for this and maybe take it a little bit further. I should have it here, just a sec. German writers, Weimar film. Okay. Somebody asked me last time, we started with some film, but also someone mentioned these films. I don't think he's here today. But German cinema is a very lively industry. It still is to this day, but we don't think that much about it because Hollywood sort of, at this time, really in the 20s, begins to take over in terms of developing a world popular culture. But German cinema was very innovative at the time, and a lot of it had this kind of dark, sinister feel to it, the sense of the monstrous, the sense of threatening and foreboding. And the most famous films from this period have that kind of dark tinge to it. Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror. This is a film based on what we know as the Dracula legend. Right? And you have all these sinister images of the Count, both in his land, coming on the ship, bringing his rats to Germany in this case, with his coffins all over the place, and sucking the blood out of healthy Western society as it sort of moves in its steady course toward decline. Right? All sorts of sinister stuff there. And another very famous film from this period is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. All shot in black and white, but this is the story of this a carnival that comes to a small town, and in the carnival there's this act of Dr. Caligari, who has this sleepwalker named Cesare, and he does his show by day, but at night Cesare is sneaking out or being unleashed to go out and sees young virgins, and they're disappearing. Right? And this whole environment of sort of madness, the night's stalker, the sexual threat, the sense that society is encroaching or is being encroached upon by these sinister forces, and all these environments of really close, tight, angular, dark shapes. Right? This, you know, sort of stands for the German Expressionist film style. It's drawn from futurism, but then it's given this dark, sinister tinge as a result, maybe we could say, of the war, but certainly of this this sense of fear and dread in the interwar period. So I correlate that with Franz, you know, that sense of the buildings are caving in on him and that he's trapped within the city. Which is communicated a number of times. Here's the nightlife which makes it into the film. Here's Marlene Dietrich's first movie, and what she plays is a nightclub singer, cum prostitute, who's very attractive with the men, and she's the Blue Angel. Right? So you have this whole world of Berlin nightlife, with heterosexual in this case, but a lot of homosexual connotations as well. Here's her top hat, which she continues to make famous through her career, drawn from that world, as I've said a couple of times. And and then it's the story, which is actually a story by Heinrich Mann, in which he goes after the academic world and the pretensions of the academic world. And in this case, this character is this really uptight professor who starts hanging around in this club and becomes obsessed with this nightclub singer, and becomes obsessed with her, really. And she just lures him down and down and down until he literally becomes a clown and dies. Right? So this path of self-destruction, of decadence, is traced. And then I save this for last because it correlates so well with the novel. Murderer Among Us, M. You know it? No? You do? Yeah. Fritz Lang's film. Fritz Lang goes into Hollywood, becomes a very well-known Hollywood filmmaker, did a lot of Westerns, strangely enough. These Germans end up doing Westerns, and that's why you end up with Marlene Dietrich singing these heavy German accented songs out in Oklahoma or wherever those films take place, which is kind of funny. But they were making films in in Berlin before this. And another young actor, Peter Lorre. Anybody recognize that name or the face? Yeah. Which other famous film do you recognize him from? He's a little guy with the German accent in... I'm not sure he's in that, but definitely Maltese Falcon.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So that whole environment of the gangster world and the sort of sinister Peter Lorre, Sidney Greenstreet, these guys sort of pulling the street strings behind the world, that comes out of this Berlin gangster cinema. And M is really even more intense than anything they did in Hollywood, because it's the story of a child murderer. Peter Lorre is a possessed individual. He's psychotic. He's just your average postal worker, right? But he's hearing voices, and these voices are telling him to kill young girls, right? So he's not in control. And it's this whole exploration cinematographically of the madman who's possessed by these voices, and he's constantly looking in the mirrors. Right, so you get those two personalities clashing with them visually. So you have the whole psychological dimension there, and then incredible collage, montage filmmaking with shots such as this sequence, which is probably the most famous sequence in the film, where actually the little girl is standing there with balloons and she's looking up at the want ad on the kiosk. Okay, and she's looking at it, it says, wanted 10,000 marks for the murderer of da 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 da. And as she's looking at it, then you just see his shadow on the kiosk. Right? Then you see him, I think, handing her some candy. Right? And they start across the street. And then the next shot is of her balloons going up and getting caught in the electrical wires. Right? So those shots alone, you put them together and you go, ugh. Right? Okay. So you can see that montage style at work. But then, because the heat is so intense on the search for the murderer, the gangsters get involved, the street crime element. And here's Franz Bieberkopf's world, right? And they go into action, and they do a better job of hunting down the murderer than the police do, and they actually seize him and put him on trial. So you end up with this trial this underground trial. I don't know if the images are here. This underground trial managed by the criminals themselves. So the world has been turned upside down in a way. Right? That's an oversimplification of it, but you get that sense. So this whole environment of the horror film and of the gangster film and the film of the street world of prostitution and popular entertainment. That's all coming out of Berlin cinematography, and it's not the only source of it, but then that gets co-opted into the film noir tradition of Hollywood. So all these things are taking place at the time that that Dublin is writing this novel, and I think we can see those as influences of that. And if you keep some of those things in mind, some of the stylistic aspects of the novel become clearer.